I am Conor MacLeod of the Clan MacLeod, and I am immortal.
Looking for a dead guy named Nash.
You talk funny, Nash. Where are you from?
Lots of different places.
I am Juan Sanchez Villalobos Ramirez, chief metallurgist to King Charles V of Spain.
Well, everybody's got their problems.
You're alive. Why didn't you die?
Hey, it's a kind of magic.
Hi, I'm Candy.
Of course you are.
Hello, and welcome to Another Time MacLeod, the only podcast, to our knowledge, that goes through that wonderful 1986 movie Highlander, scene by glorious scene, or thereabouts. I'm your host, Rob Daniel, and as always, I am very happy to say that I am joined by my splendid kinsman, Mr. Rob Wallace.
And as always, it's an absolute delight to be here.
Excellent. Well, today we are talking about a very good scene. It's actually got quite a lot of pathos in it, and for those who keep track of the time code, we are talking about the scene which goes from 49 minutes 32 to 51 minutes 57. And this is a scene when Connor, Heather and Ramirez go into the village for market day. And this is the moment when Ramirez gives some of the downsides to being immortal. And we'll talk about that as we go through the scene. It's a very well played scene. It looks amazing. The set design is great. We'll get into that too. So Rob, shall we dive into market day?
Yes. Well, the scene was shot in Glen Nevis, which is a market town. I think most of the, well, obviously you've got some permanent buildings in there that are very much of the period. And yeah, the whole scene is, it looks great.
It's interesting you say that there are some permanent buildings there, because on the audio commentary, Russell Mulcahy says that this was a set that they built. So
really?
Yeah, he said that they built it in a field. And because I thought that there were some permanent structures there as well. So it could be that they built around permanent structures. But if that is just a complete set that they built from scratch, then it's even more impressive, because it does. It just looks great, doesn't it? It looks authentic.
Yeah, it looks solid.
Yeah, that's the word, yeah.
In a way that, you know, the tower that Brenda and Connor live in, it looks great, but it is clearly a set.
Yeah, indeed. Or when you see it from the outside, it's clearly a slightly shimmering matte painting. But yeah, there are certain things here that do look, because it's only a couple of buildings as well, which is why I thought they'd scouted the location and then just built the stalls around it. Yeah, so apparently not, but yes, I mean, this was an audio commentary that was done in the early 2000s, so he was talking about something that was almost 20 years ago, so, but anyway. Whatever, it looks great. And the detail in the scene is great. There's constant movement, and the extras costume very well, and they've all got your horses and carts. And what I liked about this was that you always think of the past as being muddy and grim, but this scene's very, very colourful and vibrant. And thinking, well, yeah, because this is market day, this would be an exciting time of the week, and everyone would be in a good mood because they can buy new supplies, but they can buy new fabrics, and you get the sense of this community is really excited by the fact that it's market day.
Yeah, and you've got, you know, horses and people dancing, and you've got that fighting ring in the background. Mm. And all of these, you know, you've got that wonderful kind of establishing shot of the market. But Matt McKay also kind of peppers in shots of all these kind of, you know, closer looks at all these elements during Connor and Ramirez's conversation,
yeah,
which really does reinforce the idea of this being in the past and kind of a different world to what we know. And that, because Ramirez is basically trying to explain to Connor motivations we can discuss in a minute, that, you know, he's not going to have kids with Heather. She's eventually going to die. And I think, obviously, this isn't something that Connor's really had to confront before now.
Yeah, I think this is the darker side of the things that he's now going to have to live with, because we've just come off of that scene where he has become equal to Ramirez, but he's also experienced the quickening. He has this new profound understanding of how the world works. So it's all good. Now there's a price to be paid, and that price is the woman that he loves, who you have to think took him in after he was banished from his village and taught him to believe in people again, and who he wants to spend the rest of his life with. He's going to have to watch her die, and he's not going to change himself. And yeah, there is a pathos to this scene. There's also just and not a darkness, but like a seriousness to this scene in terms of the emotion being discussed that, again, lands really well. And it's one of these things that we always talk about, that the emotional beats of this movie are very well done. And it sounds dismissive to say it like this, but for an 80s action film, are very well done. They clearly weren't just thinking about the special effects or thinking about the big set pieces. They were thinking about how this lands with the characters.
Yeah, and it's one of the things about this film is that I've recently been rewatching, and don't worry, this will make sense in a second. I've recently started rewatching Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Right.
And the first time I ever saw Buffy, all of the characters in it were, well, you know, all the kind of the teenagers in it were, even if, you know, the actors were a bit older, were meant to be roughly my age.
Yeah.
And it's interesting how your relationship with media changes, especially things that you've loved since you were a kid, as your age changes in relation to the leads. And one thing that, you know, you kind of realize watching this scene is how incredibly young both Christopher Lambert as Connor and Beatty Edney as Heather, how young they are. Because I think Christopher Lambert was maybe, he wasn't quite 30 when he did this. And Beatty Edney was like maybe early mid-20s.
Right, okay. So you're talking about in terms of how the actors are, not just the characters, because this is within the same year that he was banished from his village. No, that's completely wrong, because he says 5 years ago you were banished from your village.
You're Connor MacLeod, wounded in battle and driven from your village of Glenfinnan 5 years ago.
So Connor was 18, so Connor's about 23 here, and you're thinking the Heather's probably about the same age, she might be a couple of years younger. But yeah, so they are characters in their early 20s, and he's just been told you are going to now spend the next 40 to 50 years watching the woman you love die, and you won't change. And they're thinking this is the beginning of, or Connor's thinking this is the beginning of his life and his relationship with his woman. And he's just been told at the very beginning, this is going to end in a heartbreak that you are going to have to live with forever.
When Shakiko died, I was shattered. I would save you that pain.
Or at least until you win the prize or someone else does. But in terms of your relationship to the actors in this and what you were saying about Buffy, what were the kind of interesting comparisons there that you were thinking?
Well, I think it's all just, you know, these actors are all, you know, probably around 20 years old. And it's interesting when you're a kid watching it, because you're aware that even though the characters they're playing are roughly the same age, the actors playing them are at least a few years older than you.
Yeah.
And therefore there's, you're kind of, it's not like a barrier between you and them, but a sense of like, you know, they're older than me. You know, the characters are my age, but those actors, cool, you know, they're at least 20, my God. And then looking back at it, your brain just kind of goes, yeah, it's fine. 16, 22, it's exactly the same.
That's interesting, because when I first came to Buffy, I was a couple of years out of university, so they were about my age. I mean, I think maybe David Boreanaz was mid to late 20s, but they were all within their 20s, as was I think. And so it was one of those where it really worked for me, because they were doing things around the same time. I mean, it was, yeah, probably 6 or 7 years since I'd been at school, but it was all very, very recent memory. So, yeah, and I've actually been back to Buffy, apart from a few episodes, since. So it will be very interesting to do a full rewatch, because that show was just so brilliant and I just loved it so much when it came out that, yes, it would be interesting to go back and obviously put all the Whedon stuff to one side, but just approach it from, you love this. This has stuck with you your entire life. These characters have stuck with you your entire life, and the events in this show, how does this now resonate that you are so much older than the age of the characters and also the age of the actors at the time here?
Yeah, and it's, I mean, yeah, there's obviously the cliche that, you know, the older that you get, you end up kind of just relating more to the parents. You know, you're grown up when you're suddenly on the side of the parents in the debate, which, you know, was never really a thing for me, because Giles was always just my go-to. The slightly stuffy Brit who loved books was like, yes, this is my proxy in this show.
Oh, I thought of myself as Xander, to be honest, because I just sort of aligned myself with Chandler from Friends. And it was like, this guy's doing Chandler from Friends, right?
Well, this may or may not survive the edit. We had the brief exchange, obviously, on WhatsApp recently, where the two sarcastic characters from Buffy and from Friends, Xander and Chandler, both of whom, you know, actors have now sadly well documented issues like mental health and substance abuse. And that, yeah, that this, that was just kind of a type during the 90s, because, you know, it's the rise of geek culture, all the kind of sarcastic, slightly... The kids who kind of previously would have been ostracized are becoming part of pop culture, becoming established characters in a way where they can be part of a unit, be part of this story.
There's also one of those things where I think a lot of the writers at the time kind of most associated with those characters, or a lot of kids who would then go on to become writers, because you then get to the MCU and it's like, oh wow, so everyone is basically Xander. Everyone has just got that snark. It was snark before we had coined the term snark. But yes, but just to get back to this scene, sorry. yeah, so on the audio commentary, Mokai says, you can't go wrong with the locations when you're shooting in some place like this. You just turn the camera on. And of course, that's not true, because all the shots here are very well composed, but it does look amazing. You can see why he starts this particular scene with a crane shot that drops down to the market. And did you notice what's happening in the field behind what looks like a solid structure?
No, I'm not sure I did.
Someone is practicing a caber toss with a friend. Well, look at that. He's got a caber, and his friend is helping him raise it, and now he's going to pick it up, and it's like, oh, that's interesting.
I know that traditionally caber toss, bagpipe music, etc. are all kind of considered to be parts of traditional Scottish culture. Did people actually play the bagpipe a lot? Like, was it like a recurring, was it a thing you'd just go out in medieval Scotland and you'd just hear somebody playing the bagpipes? If so, that must have been a real difficult time to be somebody who didn't like bagpipe music.
Yeah, indeed. And when I do like bagpipe music, but I can see why it might be. Could we invent another instrument? But of course they do. You do see other things in this. I mean, I think we've mentioned it before that I don't think they were wearing kilts at this point. I think the kilts were brought in later. So I do think there's a certain amount of artistic license taken with the depiction of Scotland here. I mean, who knows if caber tossing was a thing here, but it's like, that is someone practicing to toss the caber. Would you, in the world of this particular film and this scene, you're thinking, well, that's probably going to happen in the afternoon, right? There'll be some kind of contest for that. So, yeah. I thought in this scene, when I first saw this, when I was a teen, I thought that was Heather's stall at first, and that she was selling the chickens and it was showing how they earn their living. But of course, she's actually buying a chicken.
Is that one there? How much is it?
So we still don't know entirely how they make their living and how they earn their money.
No. It's one of those... This again, we're back in Friends territory. You know, there's no way they can afford to live in that apartment.
I mean, it does... They do live in the ultimate fixer-upper, but there's a lot of space there. I mean, you could put a floor in and get another family above you, yeah. But we do know that they have money, because Heather says that she's going to go and buy herself a dress. So I'm going to get myself a new dress.
I'll be off now. I fancy buying myself a new dress.
So as we mentioned on the last episode, where we're saying they all just seem to have one set of clothes, Heather has at least a couple of dresses.
Yeah, I mean, you don't... Maybe it's a special occasion, or she's been saving up, or... I also think it's a weird point for Ramirez to be telling Connor all of a sudden, I mean, because we don't get the lead into their conversation, that he can't have children. The fact that they're just discussing this in a public place.
I don't know. I think that's quite good, because it's like, well, you wouldn't discuss it at home because she'll hear everything that you're saying. She's got other things to do. And so now seems a pretty good time to have this discussion, because she's completely preoccupied with getting the chicken, with getting the dress and stuff like that. Also, I think it's a really, again, it just shows the attention to character and emotion that you set this dark conversation about you are going to watch the woman you love grow old and die and you will stay young, against Heather at her most vivacious and lively, and she's happy, and that just gives an extra tang of poignancy to this scene.
And you've got the opening strains of Who Wants to Live Forever.
Yes, that's right. So that comes in there as well, doesn't it? Which again is just really good.
Connor!
I mean, there's a really clever thing they do where Ramirez says, you can't have a family, you can't have children. And Connor says, that won't please Heather. And at that point, that's kind of cut around her buying the chicken. And it's like, well, one, she's not buying a dead animal, she's buying a live animal. So, the implication being that it's going to live with them. And also, she says, he's full of life.
That won't please Heather. I'll tell you that for nothing.
He's full of life.
And it's like she's with a toddler or something like that, and you just get the impression there of what a great mother she would be at the same time as being given the information. If she stays with Connor, she can never have kids. And I thought at that point, I thought, well, that's a really interesting thing here, that he could say, I have to leave you because of this. And but they never actually show if they had that conversation. It's because they don't really need to. It's all in this scene. It's he knows he's going to stay with her because this is the first time that Connor's been through this, whereas we find out that Ramirez has had three wives over the 2,437 years that he's been alive.
I was born 2,437 years ago. In that time, I've had three wives. The last was Shikiko, a Japanese princess.
And so he's had three heartaches, and each one sounds worse than the previous one, to the point where he marries Shikiko, and that seemed to be the heartbreak that thought, I can't live with this, so therefore I won't be in this situation again.
Well, Ramirez doesn't even look at Heather in this scene.
No.
At the point when she's talking to Connor, Ramirez is looking pointedly at the ground.
But there's an interesting point there as well, where Ramirez only talks about it from Connor's perspective, or from his perspective, sorry, and how he knows what Connor's going to feel. And he says, when Shikiko died, I was shattered. I would save you that pain.
When Shikiko died, I was shattered. I would save you that pain. Please, let Heather go.
And he thinks, if he'd approached it from a different tack and said, she's going to grow old and frail while you don't, you're denying her having a family, maybe that would have changed Connor's mind.
Well, you're denying her growing old with someone.
That's right, yeah. That's the thing, is that
she's going to look at you every day and you're going to be a reminder.
And at what point does your love for her become selfish? So you're kind of thinking, so Ramirez, you've been around for, again, for 2,437 years. You don't seem to have learned a lot about psychology, particularly reverse psychology. It's like, so there's a different way to approach this in terms of Connor, you love this woman, she is beautiful, you're being very selfish. And again, that's one way to look at it. Another way is that we are telling a story here that actually has some wonderful romantic sweeps and beats. And this is something that you have to see as the audience to understand the Connor of hundreds of years later and why he is so closed off. Because the second woman that he met and had a relationship with turned out to be the love of his life. And
well, he spent a mortal lifetime with her, yeah.
Yeah, then he had to go through this heartbreak of it. It's just a really well-played scene, this is. It's well-acted. There's a really good shot when Heather seems to sense that they're talking about something that isn't good when she looks at them. I think when she's buying a dress or something.
Well, I mean, she's been there for some of the conversations around the gathering and, you know, is clearly understands to a degree about, you know, what her husband is. You've got to wonder how she feels about, I mean, there's a scene coming up where they're enjoying a conversation together. But at this point, you've got to wonder how she feels about Ramirez, this bloke who's just turned up and sort of inserted himself into their lives.
Yeah, because in that shot, when she looks at them and looks very serious for a moment, you can see that she thinks, this isn't good for me and Connor. But again, I think this also goes back to the kind of time this film was made and how it would be different now, because you never get really until the deathbed scene Heather's opinion or Heather's perspective on any of this. She never is really brought into the conversation in terms of what she wants. It's it is literally from Connor's perspective. And I think that would be something different now. There would be a scene where he says, I need to leave you because of all of what being with me means. And she would say, oh, I don't care about that. But as they grow older, it could be one of those things where she begins to realise exactly what all this means.
Yeah, and I think, imagine sort of Connor saying to Ramirez, okay, what would you have me do this? Like, well, come back to Spain with me. They're much more accepting of our sort there.
Okay. Yeah. Don't want to go into that anymore?
Sorry, that's just my trying to get back into the queer theory reading.
Yes, I thought it might be. Spain is Spain? I mean,
I don't,
I know that Almodovar film sometimes will explore that in very, very good ways, but...
I now want this as a series where there's an episode where it's just like a bit like Master of None, where they just go to Spain and it's all shot in the style of an Almodovar film.
Yes, an Almodovar episode of a Highlander series. God, I would watch that.
The female characters would certainly get a bit more attention.
Yes, they would do, that's right. Yeah, so there's also, again, a very, very good potential for fan fiction here around Ramirez and his experience of marrying the Japanese princess, because he would have had to win over her father and also the wider court, because of course Ramirez would be what in Japanese is called gaikokujin, which means foreigner, but it's typically abbreviated to gaijin. And gaijin has some slightly negative connotations around it, but anyone who's lived in Japan, you kind of wear it as a badge of honour that you're a gaijin. But it is one of those things where it's like, well, you know, Japan was, well, it closed its borders for 200 years, I think, from the 1600s to the 1800s. But it has always been a very, very regimented and ordered society. So, yeah, I would love to have known the era that Ramirez went to Japan, because it's like, well, he would have been seen as an outsider all of the time. And if it was during that period when they closed their borders, then, well, he wouldn't have been able to do that. He wouldn't have been able to marry her.
Well, he was in Japan in 593 BC, because that's when Chikiko's father, Masamune, made him the sword, the katana.
You're right. That's absolutely, yeah.
Her father, Masamune, a genius, made this for me in 593 BC. It is the only one of its kind, like his daughter.
And it's interesting that a katana that was made for him by the father of the woman he loved is actually kind of one of the... It's what sets up the relationship between Brenda and Connor in the present day, because it's her discovery of fragments from that sword that lead her investigation into Russell Nash.
Yeah, and it's because it's one of a kind, like his daughter.
I am not looking for a killer. I am looking for a sword, the one used on Faziel. I found pieces of it under the garden. I only want to see the samurai.
Why?
I told you, because it's not supposed to exist. I dated pieces of the blade at 600 BC. The metal had been folded 200 times. Now, the Japanese didn't start making swords like that till the Middle Ages. So where the hell did it come from?
Yeah, that's... Again, it's just a really, really nice touch. And the reason, of course, and we'll get to it later, but the reason why he has Ramirez's sword in the present day is, again, another nice emotional beat.
Yes, and but in this scene, obviously, he hands back the sword. There's kind of, there's him saying, no, I'm going to live my life, the life as it is, as best I can. And you've got that random woman, the extra, kind of staring at Connery.
I'm so glad you said that.
Yeah.
Go on.
And on one hand, you could say, it's Sean Connery, they're filming in Scotland, it could just be a starstruck extra. But then again, he's also Ramirez in medieval Scotland, and she could just be thinking, who the fuck is this guy?
That's exactly what I've got in my notes. It's, yeah, the woman is on screen left, the very end of this scene, when Connor walks off and Ramirez watches him go. And you see her, I think, a shot beforehand, and she's got a, don't know what she's doing, but she's got her hands on her hips for some reason. But in this one, yeah, she is just staring at Connery. And I thought, that is a perfect combination of character and background artist as one, because it works on both levels. She's looking at this flamboyantly dressed man. It's also a background artist looking at one of the biggest movie stars of the period. And yeah, because she's about 5 feet away from him, you would just stare at him. You would stare at Sean and go, look at that, Sean Connery standing there. I love that moment.
You've got to wonder, how much of their conversation has she overheard?
Well, there is that as well. I mean, she could be... Again, there's a wonderful bit of fan fiction there, because as we talk about the background artists in this movie, there's so many other stories happening in this film. And yeah, she could have overheard their story and said, I think, well, all I can take from that is that he's going to live forever and that they're immortal. So...
Hard cut to, burn him!
Burn him! Yes, we should. And they're both in the stocks.
You see, Rob, this is why you don't have that conversation in public.
That's a very good point. No, you just got the wrong end of the stick. We're working on a fantasy series. It's a series of books. No one could read. Well, we're going to travel around and read aloud. Burn him! It's devilry. Also, there's, again, we're going to start to have to write down the fan fiction at some point, but you're right. So Ramirez says that the sword was made, when was it?
593 BC.
593 BC.
Yeah. So presumably Ramirez could have been around for when Jesus was born. It's like, well, got some questions for you there, mate. Did you know him and what happened and all that kind of stuff? So,
Was Jesus an immortal?
Yeah, that's...
Came back after his first death.
He did indeed, didn't he? And he's now living quietly somewhere. Just biding his time. About 2,000 years and then I'll make myself known again. Does Connor accidentally kill Jesus or does one... Oh no! Well, he should have made himself known, skulking around for a couple of thousand years.
Obviously you'd never get it into, anything, because it's technically blasphemy.
Fan fiction is where that could live.
Yeah. Yeah, a scene where, Connor's, going through Prague in the 18th century and he's half pissed and all this figure comes out of the shadows and Connor's like, Jesus! And he's like, yes!
Yes, have we met before?
Jesus, you've got to stop doing that.
Yeah, yeah, there are so many different theological questions that come out of this film. One of them being, well, you've just said BC, so questions now, mate. Questions now.
Yeah, at what point after... presumably BC was commonly used from... Actually, I don't know. That's a very good question. When did we start saying BC? Because presumably we were using Anno Domini to...
Yeah.
Because they know, otherwise they wouldn't know what year it was.
Yeah, indeed. It's, yeah.
But
so many questions. So many questions for Ramirez. It's like, actually, put the stuff about Heather to one side for one moment because I've got some other questions for you. I think we have enough time to go through both of these. On a separate point, sorry, as you would hope, Russell Mulcahy says on the audio commentary that BT Edney was just wonderful to work with and says she was a complete sweetheart. And it's like, that's good, because you just get that sense from the scenes that she's in that she would just bring the set to life or bring the locations to life. And that seems to be the case.
Yeah, and she's wonderful in this. And I think, again, she doesn't get that much to work with in terms of, dialogue or backstory. But just what she's able to embody in these scenes, that you really understand, even at this point, Connor's inability to say, okay, I understand, yeah, I will give up this woman I love, I will give up a mortal lifetime with this woman to avoid an eternity of pain, of emotional... But, as we were saying earlier, the young.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you just don't think... And there is that point, actually, that when you're in your early 20s, heavens, you just can't imagine a world without you. Or anyone that you know. It's like, I'm going to be around forever, right? Because I literally cannot imagine getting old and merging with the infinite. So I can't imagine my bones aching and my joints aching. And then, yeah... Once you're in your 30s, it's like, yep. And then when you're in your 40s, it's like, oh, I'm just going to have to reconcile myself to the fact that I'm not going to see every single Batman film ever made.
Oh, good. I mean, that's a thought. When you start thinking that the properties, the kind of...
Yeah.
Yeah, the pop culture that you love is going to... New iterations of that are going to outlive you.
Well, think about, Frankenstein and Dracula and all these sort of things. I mean, they're all still around. There's a real... And that's what comes across, I think. It's like, well, if you accept they're in their early 20s, you don't think in those terms. Again, it just adds another wonderful bit of poignancy to this scene. As does, my point earlier about when she's handling the kid and says, oh, it's full of life, and it's like she's handling a toddler or something. There's also a moment a couple of seconds later when some lads run by her, some kids run by her, and she's just really good with them as well.
Oh, you little devils. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you little devils. Go on.
It's just like, oh... She would be the best mum. And yeah, so there's just so much to think about in these character moments. Again, it's why it's a film that's worth doing a scene-by-scene analysis of.
And that's the thing, we've gone from training montage you know, end of what's a combination of a fairly traditional leveling up training montage with a bit of kind of hippy-dippy pantheistic fuel the stag into a scene that's genuinely, it's tragic.
Yeah.
It is both in the kind of classic and just general understanding, it's tragic.
Well, it certainly is leading towards that, isn't it? Because I think the tragedy comes, yeah, the last time that we see Heather, that real sense of the tragedy of this situation. This is just laying some great groundwork, but the ideas and the notions that it's raising, you're right, are the stuff of tragedy because of the romantic sweep to it, because there is just such a sense of loss that this guy is going to have to learn to deal with after realizing that his potential is so much more than it ever could have been. There's a price to be paid. And there's a really interesting thing here in terms of, I can't remember the last time we had a scene in New York. Was that when he was sharpening the sword and thinking about when he was on the boat?
Yeah.
Sometimes, MacLeod, the sharpest blade is not enough.
So this is actually because the next thing we're going to be talking about is when Ramirez and Connor are sitting towards the top of the castle they live in, and he tells them about the Kurgan. Then I think after that you get the scene with Heather. So this is actually quite a large flashback sequence that then, because we're almost approaching the middle of the movie, that's really setting up the second half of the movie. So again, the structure of this is very interesting in terms of you've had enough from New York to know that this isn't just a period film, that we are going to have a lot of present day stuff, but this stuff we can't interrupt. This has to be a an extended sequence where we see how Connor came to be.
Yeah, this is the emotional heart of the film. This is what grounds everything else.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff in here that will explain what we've seen this character from the 80s being. And then we'll go on as he realizes that he's found someone else that he thinks he loves. So yeah, it's the it is kind of the epicenter of that. It's just really good. What a film.
Yeah, and kind of, you know, using the past to develop our understanding of present-day Connor, who is a fairly undemonstrative human being. And that, you know, even in his more tender interactions with Brenda, that doesn't hugely change. He's never lovey-dovey in a way that he is with Heather.
No, and actually one of the things there you just made me think is what marks out a lot of this particular sequence is how much Connor smiles. So when he feels the stag,
I feel him! Come on!
He's got that big grin on his face and he's really happy and joyous. When he sees Heather in this scene and he puts his arms out when she's at the stall, and again, he's got that big smile on his face. There's a scene, I think, later when he's smiling at her, and then you see that her hair's beginning to turn grey and the smile kind of falters. And of course, what we haven't really seen Connor do in the New York scenes is smile. He sometimes gives like kind of a sarcastic smirk when he's talking to Garfield or something.
Want to hear another theory?
But there's no happiness other than in small moments, like when he's remembering being with Ramirez on the boat and he has that fond, yeah, memory smile on his face. But what marks this sequence out is the fact that we do see Connor at his happiest. Oh, so good.
Yeah, I personally can't imagine a scenario when, you know, you're dwelling on something that was hugely significant to you in the past to bring you joy as a way of, you know, as the only source of joy in your life. I personally can't imagine it.
Yeah, I can't imagine that either. Like the, because I mean, I've just never been that attached to nostalgia that I have to go through things from my past that I absolutely love in forensic detail to feel any kind of joy as the world collapses around me. Yeah.
From the dawn of time we came.
It's amazing that we get anything out of this film at all, really, isn't it? When we're thinking like that, yeah.
Well, the point at which, you know, for somehow some all visual media has been wiped away, and that all that survives is the podcasts, and that, you know, this is the most in-depth documentation of the whole movie.
Yeah.
When if Highlander itself ceased to exist,
or of any movie.
Yeah, it's just us and Let's Jaws for a minute. Yeah, and that's right. kind of pop culture.
And they form the basis of a new society. And of course, the original things don't exist, so they have to piece together. And then they start making films based on our descriptions of these movies. That'd be interesting.
Well, there's a play about that, similar to that, called Mr. Burns, a Post-Electric Play by Anne Washburn, which is kind of set in a post-apocalyptic future where the Simpsons has kind of become the basis of modern religion.
It is, and it's, but can you remember the episode of The Simpsons that they're talking about?
Oh God, it's Cape Fear, isn't it?
Yes, a shameless plug for my book. So I wrote a book about Scorsese's Cape Fear, and in the Impact and Legacy chapter that ends the book, I do mention that there's that play that talks, in which they just talk about the episode of The Simpsons, but then it becomes so much more than that, and it begins to become the basis of their cultural identity and society. I would love to see that play. It sounds really interesting.
The episode starts with Bart getting letters saying, I'm gonna kill you, Bart.
Right! I'm gonna kill you, Bart.
Oh yeah, that's the sound from the Cape Fear soundtrack. That's the...
Oh yeah!
Well, I think given this provided us actually an unplanned opportunity for you to plug your book, now's probably a good time to do plugs.
Yes. Whenever I mention my book, Rob gets so disgusted that it's like, right, we're going to stop it here. But I've got other things to say. No, we're stopping it here.
Yeah, sorry. Do you have anything else you'd like to say about this scene?
No.
before we continue with the crass commercialisation.
Actually, there is just one other thing, sorry. And again, it goes back to what Russell Mulcahy was saying on the audio commentary about Connery. And it's kind of around what you were saying in terms of here he is in this very, very dandy, flamboyant costume. But how he makes that not be something that looks ridiculous, and because this scene wouldn't work if you were giggling at how silly his costume was, but he just wears it so well. And Mulcahy said that Sean added a real depth to the film, and he says, the thing I always liked about Highlander was that it wasn't just an action or a fantasy idea, but it had a real emotion and depth, which is basically what we've spent about 50 minutes saying. But it's nice that the director watches it and thinks, actually, the reason why this works, I think, is because we spent time working on the emotion and the character depth, not just on the big action sequences.
Yeah, I completely agree.
Yeah. Oh, lovely scene this is. Everything, as you said, from the design and the location dressing to what's happening in it and the performances and all of the questions that it raises about Ramirez's past, all within a couple of minutes. Oh, brilliant.
Well, Mr. Daniel, if people would like to find you online, where can they do so?
Yeah. if they would like to find me online, then I'm on Twitter at @Rob_A_Daniel. And if you want to read my writing, you can at filmstories.co.uk, electric-shadows.com, or lovehorror.co.uk. And as I shamelessly mentioned, I also wrote a book, and you can find that. That is Cape Fear by Rob Daniel. So not the original novel by John D. MacDonald. This is a study of Scorsese's film, and you can find that on Amazon and Waterstones and W.H. Smith and the Liverpool University Press website, where if you type in LUP30 at checkout, you'll get 30% off as well.
Well, and yeah, I can obviously, without bias, thoroughly and genuinely recommend it.
Oh, thank you. You are my kinsman. could also recommend, if you want to hear Rob and I talk about movies more generally, the Movie Robcast, which is another podcast that we do, and you can hear that wherever you're listening to this. And if you want to follow that on Twitter, it is at Movie Robcast.
Great. And well, if you want to follow me on Twitter, you can do so at Robert M. Wallace. You can also find my writing at Of All The Film Sites, www.ofallthefilmsites.com. If you want to follow this podcast, you can do so on Twitter at McLeod Time, or drop us an email at whowantstopodforever@gmail.com.
Excellent.
Well, Mr. Daniel, as always, thank you very much. Actually, sorry, you're doing the...
Yes, sorry, I realised that we've kind of...
You're doing the lead out on this one, aren't you? Yeah, we kind of swapped places.
Well, we're just so simpatico that, yeah, it doesn't really matter who does what. But yes, okay then. Well, Mr. Wallace, thank you for a splendid discussion about, I think, one of the best scenes in this film.
Yes, thank you, mate. And it is a really lovely scene.
It is. And until next time, thank you for listening. And all that's left to say is... Another time, McLeod!
Another time, McLeod!
Clear.
Brilliant.